cancer. The word itself can cause feelings of dread, feelings of loss. Pretty much everyone listening to the sound of my voice has or will come in contact with this disease through a family member, a friend, or perhaps as a cancer patient yourself. Lots of people are working very hard to find a cancer cure. Millions of dollars have been spent on research. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network, and today we're going to talk about some of the advances in cancer research, specifically research into how we can use our own built-in defenses, our immune system, to attack and destroy cancer cells. It's called immunotherapy, and it shows some promise in the treatment of specific types of cancer. My guest is Dr. Matthew Reese, assistant professor in the Division of Hematology Oncology in the Department of Medicine and Department of Microbiology and Molecular Genetics. Dr. Reese is also an attending physician at the Medical College of Wisconsin Cancer Center and at Froedtert Hospital. Dr. Reese, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for taking time to talk about this with us. It's a really important topic. Now, there are a lot of different types of cancer. Each has its own unique characteristics. But what can we say generally about the way cancer works?
Well, I think in terms of the immune system, some of the features that are shared among various cancers is that in order for a cancer to develop, it has to basically figure out ways to evade the immune system. So the immune system is basically the system of the body that's in charge of getting rid of cells that may be infected with bacteria or viruses. And it turns out that the immune system is also very important in removing cells that have just become cancerous. And so in order for a cancer to develop, it really has to evade the immune response. And that's really shared amongst all cancer types.
Okay, so why doesn't our body's immune system attack cancers on its own? How do cancers shut off the immune system?
So cancers do a few different things to shut off the immune system. So the first thing they do is they secrete proteins that inhibit the immune system. So there are certain cytokines or secreted factors that tumors can make that makes the immune system basically ignore the fact that a cancer is there. And the second thing is that the cancers will secrete factors that draw in other cell types that can make the immune cells less able to penetrate in the tumors. So these are either fibrous cells or cells that are prevent the T cells or immune cells from directly entering the tumor. And there are other types of cells that, like the tumor cell itself, will shut off immune cells.
So we're hearing a lot about new treatments and research in the area of immunotherapy. What is cancer immunotherapy? What do we mean by that term?
So cancer immunotherapy is really figuring out ways to wake up the immune response, to recognize that a cancer is there, and then to take steps to get rid of the cancer that's formed. This has been a relatively old idea, so I think the idea has been around for over 100 years, where people have thought about, can we get the immune system to recognize that there's this malignant process taking place in the body? But I think really over the last 5 years or so, significant inroads have been generated to make this idea effective. And I think there was a lot of disappointment for a long time that these therapies weren't as effective as they theoretically ought to be. But I think in the last 5 years or so, that's really starting to be borne out, some of that promise.
Well, you say theoretically ought to be. I mean, it seems like the way you explain how our immune system works, it seems like such an obvious thing, and yet it's been frustratingly difficult to crack.
That's right. And the difference is, for instance, if you look at a vaccine, if you're trying to use a vaccine to generate a response against a virus that's infected a cell, it's reasonably easy to do that in the sense that the virus doesn't look anything like other human tissues. And if you can generate an effective vaccine, it's fairly easy to generate immune responses against a virally infected cells if you've been vaccinated. In contrast, a cancer cell looks almost like a regular cell. So it's very difficult to identify unique features of cancer cells that the immune system is able to recognize and eliminate.
Well, one of the features of some of the more well-known and generally used types of cancer treatment, whether it be radiation or some form of chemotherapy, is that they are difficult to target on only the cancer cells. So if you're taking chemotherapy, you know, there are a lot of other parts of the body are affected. Essentially, what you're doing is taking poison, and it's directed against the cancer cells, but it does other things. Radiation, same problem, although I do know that they're using, I believe it's called proton therapy. I'm probably going to get that wrong, but they have a way to maybe focus the radiation on a specific kind of tissue. But generally, that's been a problem. Immunotherapy, though, would seem to be much more specific to just the cancer cell and might not have quite as many of the side effects as other forms. Is that a fair assessment, or did I miss something?
Yeah, no,
there?
You know, that's absolutely right. So the real promise of immune therapies is you can use the exquisite specificity of certain T cells, or certain immune cells, such as a T cell that will specifically bind an individual peptide. There's millions and millions of T cells that are circulating through our body, waiting to recognize their one antigen. So it has the potential to really offer an amazing degree of specificity. I would say the other really important thing about immune treatments, especially those with T cells, is that the T cells last for the life of the individual. So if you can generate T cell responses against individual cancer cells, those T cells can be expected to remain present for the remainder of the patient's life. So potentially, and in contrast to chemotherapies, which work temporarily until the cancer figures out ways to subvert or get past the things being affected by chemotherapy, the immune system will last throughout an individual's life. And what we've seen borne out when immunotherapies have shown to be effective is that the responses tend to be of a long duration as opposed to those seen by chemotherapy and radiation.
We're talking about immunotherapy as a treatment for cancer today on the Kathleen Dunn Show, and wondering, listeners, what you might have to say about this. Have you or someone you know received this type of treatment in their battle against cancer? If so, what was your experience? Let us know, 800-486-8655. And, of course, if you have questions about immunotherapy and would like to ask the doctor about that, that's certainly a great reason to call us at 800-486-8655. Certainly, you can also send an email to talk@WPR.org or find us on social media. Look for the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and on Twitter. My guest is Dr. Matthew Reese, and we're talking about immunotherapy. I was looking at some information on the American Cancer Society website about the different types of immunotherapy. We've had some of these have been around for a while. Interleukin is one that we've used. That, of course, has some side effects to it. But we, as you point out, we've been looking at immunotherapy for 100 years. What is it that we found in the last 5 or 6 years that you talked about that really has maybe opened up a path for us here?
So, I think there's at least two treatments that have been really exciting, and both of them have been developed by a lot of great painstaking basic science research into how T cells work, how the immune system works, and how best to target the immune system to generate responses against malignancy. So while I think there was a lot of disappointment early on, I think increasingly this is going to become a major, if not the major, treatment for cancer. And so a couple of, and in fact, this was the Science Magazine, which is probably the most prestigious science journal in the world, called Immunotherapies the Breakthrough of the Year in 2013. So I think the scientific community agrees that that there have been significant changes in the field. And so I'd say one molecule of note is a cell surface receptor on T cells called PD-1 that's really changed the face of how immunotherapies work with cancer. And so PD-1 is a protein that gets expressed on T cells that are constantly running into the antigen. So the first time a T cell will see a protein, it'll become activated and eliminate as many cells as it can. But if it can't eliminate every cell and the other cells persist, basically this protein called PD-1 is a break that shuts off the T cells. And so I think once people started to develop antibody therapies against PD-1, we saw response rates in things like melanoma go from 6%, which was, as you referenced, interleukin-2, to 70%. So it really a striking difference in the ability of these therapies to work in important ways in patients.
800-486-8655, the number to call to join our discussion. If you have a question about immunotherapy as a treatment for cancer, certainly this has been a disease that has just steadfastly resisted conquest. I mean, cancer has been around for a long time, and just now we're starting to see some progress. One of the things I noted in some of the research was that we particularly have had some good luck with immunotherapy in treating a rather aggressive form of brain tumor. I believe a glioblastoma. They found, and here was, I'd like you to explain a little bit more about how the T cells work, because I was reading some of this background material. One of the things they talked about in connection with these brain cancers was that they had to more or less trick the T cells into not fighting off the immunotherapy. It was kind of like our own body was fighting against this this new thing that was coming in to say, hey, you've got these cancer cells, we need to get rid of these. And the T cells themselves were being kind of used to defend the cancer rather than get rid of it.
Right. So it turns out T cells, there's a variety of T cells. So there are T cells that will actively eliminate cancer cells, and they subtype them according to various proteins that they express and various gene changes that are altered in various subtypes. But basically, there's, for instance, a cell type called TH1 cells that is really effective at getting rid of cells that are infected with viruses and getting rid of cancer cells. And then there are other cell types that, like regulatory T cells, that basically do the opposite and try to tone down the immune response. And so over time, our immune systems have developed into really carefully balanced operations where there's on switches and off switches, and they have to be really tightly balanced to regulate immunity to prevent autoimmunity or the T cells attacking somebody's own body, like we see in various autoimmune diseases. And so that balance turns out to be really important, and depending on which type of T cell you're activating, you can have different effects in terms of blocking a cancer treatment potentially if you increase the regulatory T cells, for instance, versus enhance tumor cell clearing with the other T cell subtypes.
800-486-8655 is the number to call to join our discussion. We're talking about immunotherapy as a treatment for cancer. And new research into that, and that's showing some promise. Maybe there's a light at the end of the tunnel, and maybe it isn't a train. We're talking about that with Dr. Matthew Reese and with you. If you care to join us with a question or a comment, maybe you can share a story. Maybe you had immunotherapy at some point. How did that work for you? What do you think of this research? And what questions do you have for Dr. Reese about immunotherapy research? He's conducting it right now. And you can talk to him here on the radio at 800-486-8655. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll have some of your phone calls and more questions for Dr. Reese. Dr. Reese, one of the things I'd like to get your thoughts on, a while back there was a Mayo Clinic study that found that inoculation with an extremely large amount of measles vaccine could have an impact on refractory myeloma. And I'd like to hear your thoughts on what they found at the Mayo Clinic in regard to that therapy. And, of course, we'll have quite a bit more to talk about here. So we'll do that on the other side of this break. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Kathleen Dunn Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on the Kathleen Dunn Show tomorrow at 2 o'clock, we'll talk about the changing perceptions of the purpose of higher education with the author of a recent article in the Chronicle of Higher Education titled, The Day the Purpose of College Changed. This hour, we're talking about cancer research, specifically research into immunotherapy, ways to get our own body's immune system to attack cancer cells. It's an idea that's been around for a long time, but we're only just recently seeing some significant progress, some moving ahead and some success in treating cancer with a variety of different kinds of immunotherapy. My guest is Dr. Matthew Reese, who is both an MD and a PhD. He's an oncologist at Froedtert and at Froedtert Hospital and the Medical College of Wisconsin, assistant professor of medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and associate investigator at the Blood Center of Wisconsin. Dr. Reese, before the break, I asked you about your thoughts on the Mayo Clinic study on using a measles vaccine to treat cancer. Could you talk a little bit about how that worked and maybe that avenue of research, where that might lead us?
Sure. So I think they performed a cleverly done study in which they engineered a measles virus to be able to infect a type of blood cancer called myeloma. And they allowed it not just to infect myeloma cells specifically, but they also had the virus express a receptor that allowed you to image the myeloma cells. And what they found is that in people with disease on their skin, for instance, one patient with a myeloma that was affecting subcutaneous areas or areas below the skin, a dramatic response was observed shortly after administering this virus. And so I think that the virus probably works in a couple different ways. I think it both induces the cells dying directly from the contact with the measles vaccine. And then I think it probably also generates an additional immune response that allows for additional damage to the cancer from the immune system. I think that the disappointing thing might be that those didn't appear to be long-lasting responses, but I think the vaccine therapies in general towards cancer hold immense promise, and not just the Mayo Clinic where that particular trial was done, but I think there's a work being done at Johns Hopkins looking at listeria, which is a bacteria that acts similar to a virus in terms of infecting cells. I think there's a lot of strategies that are appearing to be quite effective in curing cancers that haven't traditionally been responsive to immune therapies.
Mm-hmm. What can you tell us about your own research? What are you working on at the moment?
So basically, we're figuring out ways to make T cells better at killing cancer cells. So while the field right now currently is mostly looking at cell surface proteins because those are the easiest to target with the antibodies and with the currently available therapeutics, we're looking inside the cells, inside the T cell itself, to see if there are off switches that we can remove to allow more robust responses against malignancies.
Well, let's hope that turns out to be a winner. We have an email from Tom in Milwaukee who writes, "I recently finished a round of BCG treatments for bladder cancer with limited results. Doctor recommended another round of BCG along with interferon. I have otherwise been very healthy throughout life. Does it often take more than one round of treatments for these kinds of treatments to take hold?"
You know, it does. BCG is a really interesting therapy, and there's an expert here, the chairman of urology at the Medical College, Dr. William C., who studies this in his laboratory. And basically, the immune response generated by BCG appears to be effective but relatively transient. So right now, there's currently work being done in the field looking at combining BCG with other things such as interferon gamma or, as I mentioned before, the PD-1 therapies to try to generate more long-lasting immune responses and so that more frequent infusions of BCG aren't required.
What is BCG?
So BCG is basically a tubercular protein. So it's clear that tuberculosis and proteins involved with mycobacterium are very potent in eliciting immune responses. And so the idea is you don't give somebody tuberculosis, but you take some of the more active components of a mycobacterial immune response and use those to directly infuse into the bladder. And because it's so irritating to the bladder, the immune system basically wants to figure out what's going on in the bladder and then will identify early bladder cancers and eliminate them.
Well, Tom in Milwaukee, I hope you have good luck with your next round of BCG and that your treatment is successful. We have an email from Glenn in Fox Lake who wonders if mesothelioma, which is related to asbestos, would be a candidate for immunotherapy.
So No, that's a great question. One of the proteins I work at my own laboratory is mesothelin, which is a protein expressed in mesothelioma. And I think mesothelioma is a very attractive area for burgeoning immune therapies because it can be so lethal and there's so few treatment options besides surgery that there's a lot of interest in developing therapies for the field. So in my own laboratory, we study ways to improve T-cell responses in mesothelioma.
And Glenn, thanks for that excellent question. Let's go to the phones, and we'll go to Madison now, where Richard is on the phone. Richard, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello.
Yeah, hi, Richard. Go ahead.
Yes, Dr. Reese. I have a coworker who has a son who has been battling cancer since he was young. He's about 15 now. And this latest reoccurrence was actually a different type of cancer, so they went through another round of chemotherapy, but it hasn't been successful, and I guess it's terminal now. So my question is, it's some sort of ocular cancer, I think, or brain cancer, I'm not sure, but how would he go about finding how his son might be eligible to maybe participate in your program?
Yeah, so I think the most important thing is getting access to people with the knowledge and information on who has the right clinical trials open and what clinical trials that he might qualify for. So certainly if he's a child, Children's Hospital here in Milwaukee and the Medical College of Wisconsin in Frederick, if you see you'll see a disease-specific specialist for your particular type of cancer, and they'll have the most up-to-date information on what trials are available both locally and throughout the United States in terms of what might be options for him, especially in thinking about the immune therapy arm, where he might take advantage of some of these new therapies.
Richard, thank you so much for the call, and I wish the best of luck to your friend's son. I know from my own personal experience that getting into a trial can be sometimes a bit like winning the lottery. I mean, some trials are very difficult to get into, and so that can be a real challenge for cancer patients for whom time is of the essence.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And, I think, unfortunately, since the people who run clinical trials, especially at the level of a pharmaceutical company, it's really important for them to eventually get FDA approval so they can sell their medication. You know, I think they design clinical trials looking for the right set of patients that will help them to prove to the FDA that their medications are safe and effective. And obviously, we couldn't do much without the pharmaceutical industry, and they've done fantastic things for both cancer treatment and other treatments. But one of the downsides, I think, to some of these clinical trials is how restrained they are in terms of their enrollment criteria.
Yeah, well, and then just as the limitations of space as well.
That's right.
There are a lot of people with cancer. I guess I kind of was exposed to a pretty amazing statistic. I was talking to a doctor who basically said, if you live long enough, you'll probably get cancer because essentially our cells break down and turn on us at some point.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. So if you look 50 years ago, heart disease was by far the leading cause of death in the United States. We've developed some really excellent treatments for heart care in the last 50 years. Cancer's lagged a little bit, so now we're seeing the mortality from cancer-related causes, in some cases, even exceed those related to heart disease. So I think cancer's lagging, and I think a robust research efforts into continuing work on cancer should reverse that trend eventually.
And you know, some types of cancer get a lot more publicity, and some are easier to study because maybe they don't act as quickly, and so patients live longer and can go through more clinical trials and things like that. And I said at the beginning of the show, each cancer seems to be unique, and that's why it's so important, for example, to know where a cancer started in a patient so that you have an idea of what you're dealing with. Are we developing better ways to detect what kinds of cancer a person has without necessarily having a specific knowledge of which organ the cancer originated in?
We are, and I think that's being informed by the improvements in genome sequencing and things like that. So now, whereas in 2000, it took them 5 years to sequence a single human genome, it can be done routinely in the lab over a couple weeks now. So technology is only improving. So I think what we'll see is more efforts to really figure out what the cancer looks like at the DNA level, and that will allow us to predict what treatments are most likely to be effective, irrespective of where the cancer may have started from. I'll also say that those same technologies are allowing us to monitor cancer responses and cancer growth just from removing serum from a patient and not doing expensive and painful biopsies. The technology that is being worked on by several people here at the medical college is looking at how do we take so-called liquid biopsies or take a milliliter of a patient's serum to kind of assess the cancer response.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we have more callers, and we have lines available if you'd like to join the discussion at 800-486-8655. Dr. Matthew Rees is with us. We're talking about immunotherapy for cancer treatment. New research in that. It's very promising. We're discussing what the ramifications of all of that are. Mary is with us next from Milwaukee. Mary, hello. Thanks for joining us today.
Hello, Dr. Rees. Specialty drugs have become cost prohibitive. As these procedures evolve and develop, it would be great if checks and balances could be implemented to prevent these procedures from becoming exorbitant in their cost and how it impacts on people in everyday life and the profiteers. Let's keep them out of this.
Mary, thanks so much for the call, Mary. Cancer treatments pretty costly, but so's the research.
That's true. Having said that, I think I see patients myself in the cancer center, and if most of the time we can find ways either through the drug makers themselves or through other avenues to try to permit care when possible, but occasionally it is the case where we can't provide a medication because of its exorbitant cost, and I'd say that's obviously not an optimal situation, something that makes us lose sleep at night when something like that occurs.
Well, I mean, even if you have terrific insurance, you can still end up with some pretty hefty bills at the end of the day, just because of the cost of these treatments, and they multiply over the months. And if you have hospitalizations and specialists and all of this, it does add up. Our phones have suddenly filled up, so let's take some more calls. We'll go to Milwaukee, where Dave is waiting. Dave, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was diagnosed with prostate cancer in 2008, had the Venti robotics and then radiation, and I was good for about 14 months, but now it's come back. I'm stage 4 prostate cancer, and I was wondering if there's anything out there that looks like it can get rid of it for good.
So I would say that probably your best option is to see somebody who specializes in prostate cancer. At the medical college, there's 4 of us who specialize in the treatment of prostate, bladder, and kidney cancers, and we can talk in more details about specifics of what might be available. I'd say in terms of curative options for metastatic prostate cancer, I think there are things in the pipeline that might offer that. That you should be interfacing with an academic center and making sure that you might have access to.
Dave, thanks for the call and good luck. But that's one of the things that can be really tough for patients, and that is figuring out how to navigate the system and knowing who to talk to. And I know that we have the American Cancer Society advocates for patients, and I certainly know that, I mean, doctors want to advocate for patients, but sometimes it can take quite a bit of effort for a person to really engage the right part of the system to get the kind of treatment that they really need. Can it?
I think you're right. I mean, if I sprain my ankle and look up ankle sprain therapies online, I have a tough time navigating exactly what the best steps are for me to, you know, put ice on my ankle. So I can't imagine somebody with cancer trying to navigate all of the potentially misinformation and unreliable information that they might encounter on the internet. And I think you really need to find a medical oncologist you're comfortable talking with and discussing options and really learning about the cancer at a personal level.
And not just information, bad information you might find on the internet, but the emails from someone who says, "Oh, my cousin Claude went here and got this therapy," and everybody has a lot of advice for cancer patients, and all with the best of intentions, but it can really be confusing.
Right. No, I absolutely agree. And as you alluded to before, cancers are very different depending on the organ system, depending on the subtype of cancer. So a therapy that might be really effective for one type of cancer might not work well at all for even a slightly different cancer.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. Let's take one more call before we go to break, and we'll go to Wally, who's up in northern Wisconsin. Wally, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. I don't want to disagree with your guess, but I was getting BCG treatments, and I came down with tuberculosis, and I had to go to an infectious disease specialist. As they cured that, it shut down my pancreas, and so I got diabetes. But I did end up with tuberculosis from BCG.
Yeah, well, I don't want to discuss the specifics of a case. I'll say that in general, BCG is provided by urologists, so that's my area technically is in medical oncology, not in urology. So I think for specifics in terms of the potential side effects from BCG and things like that, you'd probably get better advice from a urologist or urologic oncologist than from a medical oncologist.
We could probably do another show on that. Wally, thanks for the call. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we have some emails that I'd like to get to as well and more questions for Dr. Reese. We're talking about immunotherapy as a treatment for cancer. New advances in science have given us some glimpses into how we might be able to get our own body's immune system, which is incredibly powerful, to actually fight cancer. It's an idea that's been around for a long time, but technological breakthroughs probably in the last decade or so have made it a little easier for us to study this and to come up with strategies, some of which seem to be working quite well, or at least showing significant promise. Dr. Matthew Reese is with us. He's a researcher in this field, and we're kind of talking about some of these things, taking your questions as well at 800-486-8655, talk at WPR.org, or find the Kathleen Dunn Program on Facebook or Twitter and leave your comment or question there. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to this program on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we're talking about immunotherapy as a treatment of cancer. A lot of research being done into that right now, and some promise is shown. We're not all the way home yet. But certainly we're finding new ways to unleash our own immune systems, quite powerful in their own right. They keep us healthy most of the time, and we're finding ways to engage that immune system to help destroy cancer cells. And talking with Dr. Matthew Reese about that as we go along through the hour here, Dr. Reese, one of the things that strikes me is, you know, cancer patients, the one thing that they're really looking for is hope. Because that cancer diagnosis is one that really can stop you in your tracks, and we want to be careful not to oversell a certain therapy. And doctors are always pretty conservative in their estimates, but that's one of the things, really, isn't it, that makes this such a challenging field? We want to give people hope, but we know that we have a ways to go.
I think that's right. I think we're getting closer. So I think in certain types of malignancies like melanoma and some other cancers where we're really seeing things like PD-1 show tremendous activity, and in re-engineered T-cells in refractory leukemia, I think we've seen some amazing strides. But overall, I think we need to be relatively temperate in terms of whether or not this will be effective in other types of cancer tomorrow. And I think that's one of the areas in which immunotherapy initially struggled, because I think the first, in the 1980s, people were discovering therapies that would occasionally work in certain types of cancers with the IL-2 and things like that. And they generate a lot of press and a lot of excitement. But then when that initial excitement waned and there was nothing behind it that should show that this would be a routine treatment, I think there was a tremendous amount of disappointment in the field. So I agree that we need to be somewhat temperate in terms of our enthusiasm. Having said that, I think this is a great opportunity for things like the NIH and the NCI to increase their funding. I think it's bearing enough improvement right now that I think it should be a focus of the government's funding efforts.
Well, for those of us who've lost family members or close friends to cancer, we would say that you can't spend too much money on getting rid of this disease because it really is a scourge. Here's an email from Roxanne, who would like to ask that you speak on the connection between viruses and cancer, with HPV in both men and women being a cause for certain forms of cancer. Are there other viruses that can cause cancer?
Sure. So I think in the late 1970s, there's a lot of thought that viruses were the major cause of cancers. So a lot of the proteins that are we've identified in cells carry with them associations with viral proteins, and things like RAS and things like that, because they're these growth factor proteins, because they're identified over the course of virus research. So I think in the late 70s, people thought that viruses cause cancer in most instances. I think increasingly we're finding that while certain viruses can certainly cause cancer, like as was mentioned, the HPV causing cervical cancer, that association is clear and there are clear driving proteins present in HPV. I think it's perhaps more specific to individual types of cancers than it is across the board. So I think in general, things, very common cancers like lung cancer and breast cancer, things like that, don't tend to be associated with viruses and tend to be associated with individual mutations in proteins inside the cell. Although certainly there's you can find examples in the literature that identify certain subsets of cancers that might be associated with viruses.
Mm-hmm. And thanks for that email, Roxanne. Here's an email from Terry, who writes, we have a 21-year-old friend that was diagnosed last year with glioblastoma multiforme stage 4. He has been going through multiple treatments and has recently been told the tumor's growing again. Time is limited for finding further solutions. Can you suggest some place for him to contact to get some help this far into the illness?
So I think calling the Medical College of Wisconsin, if they're in Milwaukee or another academic facility in a different city, they'll identify for each patient the specialists that are seeing that specific cancer. So you'll get individual cancer-specific expertise depending on whatever subtype that you may be suffering from. And I think that's probably the best avenue to take, and then to discuss in detail with that provider who's an expert on a particular cancer what the options might be, and like I said before, what trials might be open both locally and throughout the United States.
Okay, let's see. Let's take another phone. Whoops, we just lost one of our callers. Let's go to Doug in Oregon. Doug, thanks for joining us. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I just tuned in recently, and I heard you mention about glioblastomas, and plus on the last call. Do you know if immunotherapy has any positive effects or any reason for optimism with inoperable brain tumors? It's called oligodendroglioma.
Sure, an oligodendroglioma, which is a stage 3 glioblastoma. Right now, it's a really active area of research in immunotherapies. It's a cancer that has some features that might be amenable to being treated with immune therapies. Nothing really that might be FDA-approved tomorrow, for instance, but I think in the future, that's one area that is specifically being addressed in the field of immunotherapies.
Yeah, and they're doing some research in Europe on this, too, as well, I believe. Some of the recent discoveries were, I want to say Switzerland, but that could be wrong. I know they've been, I mean, obviously, cancer research is taking place all over the world. I mean, this seems to be a huge, well, it doesn't seem to be. It is. It's a huge undertaking. There are a lot of doctors and scientists everywhere who are looking at this.
That's right. And I think there's a lot of great work being done in Europe, too, so not to downplay any contribution that they're making to the field of immunotherapies for cancer and cancer research in general.
We had a, I don't know if this was a Facebook post or an email, but Stu is wondering about any kind of nutrition-based therapies for cancer, perhaps to stimulate our immune systems. I don't know.
There's some work being done on it. It's not my particular area of focus, so I don't want to speak on that. It's a little bit far afield from what I'm comfortable really addressing.
Well, that's fine. I guess one of the things that makes this such a tough topic to discover is that we hear the word cancer, and yet that word really is so abstract as to, I don't want to say it's meaningless, but there are so many different kinds of cancer, and when we talk about each one, they all have individual characteristics, individual research, individual treatment models, and so forth, that, we don't really, I mean, this is so complicated, I'm even having trouble framing the question. When we talk about things like, well, what causes cancer? The question is almost foolish because there are so many different kinds of cancer. The answer is, well, which one are we talking about? Are we any closer to getting an idea of where cancers really come from, what really causes them?
Right. And the term cancer is definitely thrown around with a lot of, without... with the broad definitions, for instance, Gleason 6 prostate cancer, the field can't agree if it's really cancer or not because the cells don't have all the features typical of a cancer cell. I agree with you that the term cancer is very broad and it means very different things in different cancers. And I'm sorry, could you repeat your question?
Well, I don't even remember it now. But I guess, the idea is, when we talk about what causes cancer, I mean, the question is almost foolish because there are so many different kinds of cancer and each one could have something else that caused it. But, I mean, is there some characteristic or aspect of this that we can identify and say, okay, this is what causes cancer, or is the question
right.
Silly?
I think there are some risk factors that appear to convey a general increased risk of cancers or a broad variety of cancers, so maybe not all cancers, but things like cigarette smoking, obesity, those types of things have been broadly associated with several cancer classes. So there are some things that appear to be important in terms of increasing one's overall risk of cancer. But again, it's very specific. It can be very specific. And the other thing that I don't like to see occurring is when people are kind of blamed that their past behaviors are responsible for their cancers because nobody has done anything bad enough to deserve cancer, for instance. And I think a lot of that negativity, I think, is not necessarily good. But I think there are some global risk factors like cigarette smoking, obesity, that increase a number of different cancers in an individual and elevate their overall likelihood of developing cancer at some point in their life.
We have some more online comments. Here's one from Facebook. Carrie writes, I am 40 years old and was diagnosed with GBM, astrocytoma grade 4, in June of 2013. Have had surgery, radiation, and chemo. Does any of this preclude me from immunotherapy trials?
So I don't think it does. If a trial is available for glioblastoma, that type of therapy is fairly standard, so I wouldn't think that it would preclude somebody from enrolling in a clinical trial. I think some of the features of the immune system that make the immune system work better include a low volume of disease. So I think if somebody has a lot of cancer, trying to generate a robust immune response against the cancer is less likely than if they have small volumes of disease. So,
well, and if somebody's got a compromised immune system, that would also be a problem.
It would be. That's correct. So if somebody's taking steroids or doing other things to decrease their that are immunosuppressive, using an immunotherapy probably is less likely to work. Although if you look at certain therapies like ipilimumab, which is a drug that's used for melanoma that predates the PD-1 therapies that blocks another receptor on the surface of T cells, people had to receive steroids because of some of the side effects that the ipilimumab was causing, and it didn't appear to affect the efficacy or the ability of the drug to work that much. But I think everybody deep down inside thinks that immunosuppressants probably negate a lot of the effect of immune therapy.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, some cancers move so fast and attack the body's ability to even use chemotherapy. For example, a cholangiocarcinoma, which is a bile duct cancer. In some of these really fast-moving cancers, is there even time for immunotherapies to take hold?
No, that's a great point. I think the kinetics of generating an immune response are on the order of at least weeks and perhaps longer. So I think this strategy isn't necessarily optimal if somebody has a rapidly growing cancer that it needs immediate treatment.
So let's see. I've got too many notes in front of me. We had here's an email from Ginny. That's what I wanted to go to next. Sorry to be so disorganized here. A family member who had stage 3 breast cancer treated in 2005 has now been diagnosed with metastatic bone cancer. Is there any hope for immunotherapy for bone cancer?
So it depends on the type of cancer in the bone. So I think myeloma in general seems to be a cancer that is amenable to immune therapies. But it really depends on if it's from a cell originating in the bone marrow, like a myeloma or a lymphoma, as opposed to an osteosarcoma or a cancer originating from bone tissue. I think those are two separate things.
Yeah, and again, that's one of the things that makes it difficult for people to understand is that there's so many fine points in here. Yes, this, but that, and okay, but that doesn't apply over here because this is different from that. And it can be really, really confusing. And there's, as you pointed out, a person can go to the internet and get tons and tons of really bad information. So where can we go to get reliable information about treatment and about cancer and about cancer research? Where would you point us?
So, for instance, there are people in my family who develop cancer, I tell them to see a specialist that knows that cancer in great detail and to see them and have them. Part of the job of an oncologist is to parse through the information in the literature and identify the things that make sense and things that can be offered to a patient. So I really think it's important to see an expert in your particular cancer and have a discussion about what the cancer means and what the treatment options are.
Well, and hopefully your internal medicine, your family practice doctor can steer you to that specialist, because that can be one of the other problems is identifying where these specialists are and how to get in touch with them. It's not like you can just walk in off the street and say, hey, I'm here to see so and so. It can be a really complicated process to navigate that whole area of the medical profession as well.
It can be, and I would say that at the Frederick we have a great website that can help try to direct patients, but even it can be very confusing to people, especially with a recent emotional trauma of a cancer diagnosis and things like that, to navigate websites and things like that. So I think it's a great point to talk to your internist and get advice on where to go.
So we've got about a minute or so left of the program. Where do you think is going to be, and I guess this is maybe not a great question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Where do you think the next breakthrough is going to come from in terms of immunotherapy? What's the most promising line of research right now?
So I think the most promising area right now is in redirecting patients' T cells to identify and kill cancer. So you take T cells out of a patient, you activate them in vitro and refit them with the appropriate weaponry to go in and eliminate cancer cells, and then you infuse them back in the patient, either with or without a gene that can kill the T cell after it's done its job. I think that's really one of the most important areas that the field is moving towards. And I think that's an area that holds promise. It's shown, several centers have looked at it clinically. We're looking at it both in T cells and NK cells, a different type of immune cell at the medical college. And I think right now it's useful in clinically in treating leukemias and lymphomas. I think once we're able to figure out how to appropriately reconfigure the T cells to kill more common malignancies, that to me seems like where the biggest breakthrough will be in the next several years.
Dr. Rees, thank you so much for a very informative hour. I really appreciate your time, and good luck in your research.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Dr. Matthew Rees, oncologist at the Medical College of Wisconsin. K.P. Whaley produced this hour of programming. Scott Myers and Lisa Nalbandian handled on-air production. We had so many calls and emails, we didn't get to them all, but you can continue the discussion on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to this broadcast on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.